Close your eyes and you can see the island and its inhabitants as they must now look. Under every palm tree, a pile of records. A communal Bible and Shakespeare and a grass hut for everyone to visit. Lines of feckless castaways on the beach looking for a passing ship, having given up the struggle to build a tree house. Everywhere, people cherishing their luxuries. Pianos, brass bedsteads and cooking pots as far as the eye can see. Lord Whitelaw and Lord Hailsham singing in separate baths, perhaps having borrowed Frank Muir's naval brush or Tito Gobbi's back scratcher. Alfred Hitchcock studying his European railway timetable. Arthur Scargill with the Mona Lisa. Arthur Rubinstein with a revolver. Hermione Gingold gazing at the Albert Memorial. Harry Secombe giggling at his scale model of broadcasting house with everyone in it. And somewhere under the trees, Sue Lawley's cool linen sheets awaiting nightfall. But blink again and you see it as of course it is, deserted and waiting for you, with not a footprint in the sand.
I know from what I've been told by my guests and what I've read here and there, necessary research, I know quite a lot about desert islands, and I know that they are not places to go to. There was a time when the BBC suggested I should go on a desert island and give a talk about how I was getting on each day. But, well, I know that there are so many thousand kinds of poisonous berries and that there's a kind of fish that you must not eat and you mustn't cut your foot on this kind of coral, etc., etc. I know so many of the hazards that I'm not looking for that sort of trouble.
Roy Plumley found the idea terrifying, but he supervised it benignly for 43 of the 50 years of Desert Island Discs, years in which about 2,050 castaways have been presented with the formula that hardly ever fails.
Anything which puts a lid on it, like desert islands and things like that, because it's assumed in the desert island, of course, that you will never be rescued. You'll be discovered as a skeleton there with discs around you, like halos. Anything like that, of course, produces a certain tension and a desire to explore yourself in order to see what you really would like in those moments.
Sir Peter Ustinov, than whom no living person has been dispatched to the island more often. He's been cast away three times. It's precisely that sense of risk that is irresistible. Not just the notion of the island's own danger, but of course the knowledge that in the programme, at the very moment of your greatest self-indulgence, as you choose your discs and your book and your luxury, you're probably revealing much more than you intended. Or the knowledge that if you've tried too hard to impress, your bluff is probably being called.
I think it's enormously difficult to conceal something that is genuinely a part of you. And I think that that is why the format is such a clever one. Desperately simple, but very clever, because it gives the person in the chair an opportunity to ask all sorts of seemingly mundane questions, but the answers are revealing.
Sue Lawley's style is very different from Plumley's, but the trick is the same as it was in the 40s, the cover of fantasy for personal revelation.
I do like doing things with my hands, so I think I would just about be all right. I'm quite a fast learner.
Would you try to escape?
I don't think so, because I'm cautious by nature. And I would just hope that someone would come and rescue me. My dreams would go that way.
A typically revealing glimpse of a personality that didn't seem quite so ironclad a year before Mrs. Thatcher began the important phase towards the zenith of her life. Other castaways like Richard Ingram's have found the island itself to be the pinnacle.
The format of the island is a brilliant idea which is now lodged in the national consciousness. And when I was invited on in 1971, I felt that that was the supreme achievement of my life, and that everything since has been downhill.
The story of the programme is the story of an idea that worked instantly.
I was freelancing for the BBC, and I was looking for an idea for a series of six. And it was a very cold November night. That would take us back to November 1941. And I was in my pyjamas, and I was just going to bed. And suddenly I had this idea. Now, when I get an idea, what I usually do is scribble a few words on a piece of paper, shove it in a drawer, come across it months later and say, what on earth is that, and throw it away. But on this occasion, I did actually act. At once, I sat down at my typewriter, shivering as I was. I was in my pyjamas and wrote to the BBC about it. And I'm very glad I did, because they wrote back and said, yes.
Mind you, he had to write again to make it clear that he didn't intend the castaway to choose the records alone. He wanted to be in charge. By the end of January 1942, he was on the air with his first castaway, the musician and comedian Vic Oliver. But it was also an idea that everyone expected to wither with age, and his widow Diana says that the BBC shared that scepticism.
When he began, the BBC gave him a contract for 6 programmes. And it was a joke of his that right to the end of his life, they hadn't got obviously very much faith in him, because always the contract was for another 6. But it went on, he did it for 43 years.
There was certainly a snootiness about Desert Island Discs in some parts of the BBC, and it has had its crises, which we'll come to later. But back to the beginning, when no one knew quite what lay in store. We've had Plumley's own account of his inspiration. But had a seed been planted unknowingly much earlier? He was a reader of Rhythm magazine, and a friend of his, Spike Hughes, had played the game in an article in that magazine, listing his records and asking his readers to do the same. Indeed, Spike Hughes himself had suggested the idea to the BBC earlier. And a step further back, he in turn may have come across this.
Marooned with a Gramophone. A recital of gramophone records chosen by E.R. Appleton and Andrew P. Yates. Between the items, they will defend their selections.
Marooned with a Gramophone, a programme broadcast in the western region of the BBC from Bristol in July 1932. By whatever route, the thought was turned by Roy Plumley into the programme we now know.
The BBC presents Desert Island Discs.
Yet in those days, it was rather different. Firstly, surprisingly to us now, it was scripted. Not only did Plumley write the questions, but he wrote the answers too. After talking to the castaway, he wrote a script, and they delivered it, sitting with a microphone between them, actors in a radio play. Here's one of the earliest editions still preserved, from 1951.
In this programme, a well-known person is asked the question, if you were to be cast away alone on a desert island, which 8 gramophone records would you choose to have with you? Assuming, of course, that you also had a gramophone and an inexhaustible supply of needles. The programme's introduced by Roy Plumley.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? On our desert island on this occasion is a large man with a flourishing moustache. He's a Cambridge graduate, an ex-RAF pilot, a Sussex farmer and rider to hounds, president of the Barnes Brass Band, and you may have heard him on Take It From Here. That's a radio show. Professor Jimmy Edwards.
Thank you, Plumley. You are, I believe, asking me to suppose that I've been cast away on a desert island.
That's exactly it, and all you've got with you is a gramophone.
I can't imagine anything more ghastly. Must I have a gramophone?
Oh, but Edwards, I can't believe you're not fond of music. I mean, you, one of the most eminent musicologists in the racket.
Well, I would hardly... Well, I.
You've given so many instructive and enjoyable musical lectures on the air.
Well, I, yes, I know, but I mean, always as a creative musician, blowing my own examples. Now, if I could take my euphonium onto the island, I could give myself endless enjoyment and keep myself fit.
It's no good arguing, Edwards. You have a gramophone and that's all, and it's hand-wound, and 8 records.
Well, it sounds stilted now, but it's easily forgotten that in its early days the programme was breaking new ground. The script may have guaranteed safety on air, but Plumley had done his research, and he was determined to reveal something new about the character sitting with him. Indeed, from the start, it was made clear by Leslie Perrone, who accepted the idea at the BBC, that it shouldn't be at all frivolous. He wrote to Plumley, "You should impress upon your shipwreckees that they're not, in fact, spending a couple of nights on a sun-drenched island, but that they must sit down and consider very seriously what sort of mood they would be in after about 6 months entirely alone with their gramophone." The idea of the island was always central, alluring and intimidating. And demonstrating that was part of Plumley's purpose in the routine he followed before every programme. He gave lunch to the castaway at one of his clubs, one for men and another one for women. partly as a way of producing a relaxed encounter at the microphone in the afternoon, but also as part of a ritual to stress the importance of the experience that was to follow. This wasn't a journey to be entered upon lightly. After lunch, there was the visit to the gramophone library, where the records were to be looked out. Derek Drescher, who produced the programme for 9 years until Plumley's death in 1985.
We used to allow an hour and a half going through the records with them. If they didn't know which version of a symphony they wanted, I'd bring four varied versions along and make them listen to all bits from all four and say, you know, we've got to choose one, we're not going to choose it. So it was a very personal thing, and we really gave the music a great importance.
It was inevitable that with one man at the helm for more than 40 years, the programme would develop a character that resisted change when the form had been established. By the mid-50s, it was there. So many people had asked for Shakespeare or the Bible that they were to be provided unbidden. The luxury crept in, sought by castaways who wanted something special with them. And from the start, special requests were often rather bizarre. My Zetterling took as an extra ninth record a recording of applause, because even on the island, she said she couldn't do without it. The pattern fixed, Plumley settled down for 3 decades, imprinting his style on it. And years later, castaways like Richard Ingram's found the formula as potent as ever.
I think the art of interviewing, basically, is to put people at their ease. And Roy Plumley was brilliant at doing that. He did this thing of inviting you out to lunch before the programme at his club, so that by the time you went into the studio, you felt that he was your chum. So that the whole atmosphere was very relaxed. And, of course, you never felt that Plumley was going to spring some nasty surprise on you.
And almost always strict propriety was observed. Personal tittle-tattle was expunged most of the time anyway. There was an encounter with a certain opera singer whom Plumley knew to have appeared naked in earlier days in an extremely risque film, and he asked her about it. Rather wisely, she uttered not a sound, and as a result the exchange couldn't be broadcast, but that was an exception. Mostly politeness reigned. The rudeness came from the guests. Most famously from the film director Otto Preminger, who, it seemed, had either had too good a lunch or simply decided to cause trouble.
You said nice things about Charles Laughton. You paid tributes to other actors. But there are actors who worked for you who say that you're very tough on the set. In fact, that you're rather a frightening man to actors and something of an ogre.
Who told you that? Which actor told you that? You are incredible. You read things and you believe everything bad about me.
No, I was giving it to you to deny.
I don't deny it. No. The only thing that I don't like, that I can't stand, are actors who are late or who don't learn their lines. Otherwise, I'm very patient, so don't say I'm tough. Take it back.
I take it back.
Okay. You're lucky that you did.
Mr. Preminger, you're an independent and self-reliant man. Could you look after yourself on a desert island?
Could I look after myself on a desert island?
Yes. Could you build a hut? Are you any good at carpentry?
Build a hut?
Yes.
You must be out of your mind. I can't even build a box, anything. Can you build a hut?
No.
Then why do you expect me to build a hut?
I don't expect you. I just wanted to know, with an inquiring mind, if you thought you could build a hut.
And as his book, Preminger chose his own autobiography. Arguments were rare, though sometimes Plumley's implied attitudes stirred up bad feeling. Here he is with Vic Feather, then General Secretary of the TUC.
Our strike record is diabolical, isn't it?
Diabolical. Why should you say diabolical? What do you know about it? You know very little about it, if I may say so. Diabolical. Last year we lost 25 million days out of 5,000 million days. Now you can work that out faster than I can. That's, I think, what, 0.2 of 1%? So you're going to weep into your beer all day and all night and all through the future and rent your clothes and put acid on your hair because we're only getting 99.8 of possible. We're better than the United States, we're better than Canada, we're better than Australia, we're better than Japan. And why do you say then our record is diabolical? You know, this business of some of you lads being self-denigratory, I don't mind you being self-denigratory, you Throw rubbish at the TUC if you want. Throw rubbish at the BBC if you want. But you must be sure of your facts.
Are our labour relations getting better?
Well, they're better if some people like yourself, if I might say so, wouldn't keep on saying that they're diabolical.
And off the air, there were more delicate problems. One actor was so drunk that he had to be asked to come back the next day and re-record the programme sober, which he did. One actress broke down in hysterical sobs at several points in what she thought was a rather gruelling interview. A programme with Muhammad Ali couldn't be broadcast because he was considered incoherent. And on one occasion, the wrong man was interviewed. Instead of Alistair MacLean, the thriller writer, there arrived Alistair MacLean, the head of the European office of the Ontario Tourist Board. He did a good interview, but it stayed unbroadcast. And in 1979, Norman Mailer caused trouble.
I would take a stick of the very best marijuana I could find, and I would save it for years and hope it didn't get too stale, because I'd know that I would have one opportunity to smoke it, and only one. And so I'd wait for that perfect day on the desert island when all the conditions were right.
This is a legal talk, Mr. Mailer.
Well, here we are in trouble again.
And he got away with it. Princess Michael of Kent couldn't take her cat as the luxury because after a glut of animals in the early 50s, it was ruled that the luxury had to be inanimate. The programme has survived because it has changed with the world around it, and at the same time, it has managed to appear as if it's been the one certainty, the one unchanging pillar around which everything else has revolved. Not only has it changed, it has on occasion blazed a trail discreetly. Sometimes you may hardly have noticed. In 1967, Jeremy Thorpe, who was then leader of the Liberal Party, was the castaway. But no sooner had the programme been broadcast than a hailstorm was descending on Plumley's head. Anna Instone, the head of Gramophone Programmes, wrote to her boss, "I've reprimanded the producer, and I will see Roy Plumley when he returns from his holiday. This will not be the first occasion on which I've had to speak to him about leading questions, a matter in which he seems to be singularly uncooperative." The assistant head of radio replied, "It's quite clear that we must keep politics out of Desert Island Discs." The point simply was that in 1967, nobody knew how a politician should be handled outside current affairs programmes. It just wasn't done. And it reminds you that Desert Island Discs, sometimes considered so tame, was the pioneer of what became the chat show.
But I do it, you see, when I'm talking to people like you, I will deliberately frighten them into making them talk to me, and you do it completely the other way around. I think it's a shame to frighten people because they're inclined to curl up and get a bit tense. I mean, I will say very little and let them get on with it. I mean, why should I do all the work?
It's as simple as that.
I mean, other people, for instance, who will use the platform that you offer to them, as I was strongly tempted to appear to be musically most staggeringly erudite and eclectic.
Yes, indeed. I will sometimes use the alcohol breakdown. I find this very useful. We've been discussing the musical choice, and it doesn't look quite right. So I say, well, let's go out and get a breath of air. Shall we go across to the pub for a few minutes? And a couple of large gins, and then I will say, now, there's one record in this list that doesn't seem to match the others, and slowly and rather grudgingly comes out the confession about the musical brother-in-law, who's recommended something slightly esoteric, but very good.
Plumley with Russell Harty laughing in the background. The trick then, and now, was to glean something, apparently by accident, by transporting someone to a different and an unfamiliar world. The publisher, Lord Weidenfeld, talking to Sue Lawley.
I'm hopeless mechanically and not fit for the 21st century when it comes to mechanical things.
But can you at home manage to put on the kettle? I mean, can you make a cup of tea?
No, I can't. Unfortunately, it's not an affectation. I'm just hopeless. I can't drive a car, and I'm dependent on others.
And how else would we have found that out?
They know, really, when they accept the invitation, that they are handing over to you a licence, really, to explore them in a way that perhaps they have not been explored before for public consumption. And in accepting the invitation, they are also agreeing that they will come along and spread themselves before you. If they're clever, they've decided which bits to spread and which bits not to spread.
Have you had the sense of someone, perhaps,
pouring out much more than he or she had expected to or perhaps wanted to when they came into the studio.
Yes, because you see, there's something very moving for people in talking about themselves and in linking memories back through the years with pieces of music that evoke those times in their lives that are important to them. And those are the pieces they've willingly chosen in agreeing to play the game. But when they actually are here going through it and laying it before you, they suddenly re-experience them. And they do become quite revealing. They do become quite emotional. People do cry.
The essence of the programme is the probe that you hardly feel going in. In the psychiatrist's chair, without the psychiatrist, and without the chair. Which of us who listens hasn't wondered if a particular choice of records hasn't been made for effect rather than as a personal statement? And who hasn't been surprised at a completely unexpected personal revelation? Who can forget, for example, the singer Elizabeth Schwarzkopf choosing 7 records by herself? The BBC had begun to worry about pop singers asking for their own records to be played. What a surprise it was to find that it was an opera star who was trying, it seemed, to bend the rules. And you were always aware that there were rules. If they were to be relaxed, it was in Plumley's gift.
I must say, Roy Plumley made the whole thing very engaging because he always looked like a kind of surprised and overgrown leprechaun. And it's very rare that one is invited to be shipwrecked 3 times. I think Prospero only had one go at it in The Tempest. But they didn't have to choose discs, of course. I would say, in any case, interviews, I find extremely useful things. People say that you must get asked the same question all the time. It isn't really true. In order to answer questions, you sometimes are compelled to crystallize your opinion. And you hear it almost for the first time, things that you have felt, but have never bothered to express, unless you're under the pressure of a question.
You talk of Plumley as a surprised leprechaun. His style was very straightforward in the sense that the questions quite often were statements simply asked in a rhetorical way. It was a very straight form of questioning, and yet he did appear to be able to get quite a lot out of people. What do you think the secret of that success was?
Well, because it all seemed slightly ingenuous. He was much cleverer than he seemed to be. And he had a variety of techniques. I'm sure he had it worked down to a fine art, because really he was the pioneer, and nothing was quite as blatantly successful as he was, because it was always an adaptation. He wasn't an adaptation. He had this idea, and he sat with that freckled look. He looked like Kinnock with a turbo, in a way. He was really covered in generosity and smiles. And you didn't suspect that some of the questions were really loaded in order to get an answer of some kind of surprising quality out of you.
As Sir Peter Ustinov says, he did appear sometimes an innocent, but Plumley was not devoid of feelings about the castaways. His other life as a playwright, only moderately successful, did sometimes erect emotional obstacles, as Derek Drescher recalls.
Yes, yes. In fact, he wrote quite a lot of plays which were regularly performed in rep, but only one ever reached the West End, and I think it disappeared within about a week. But it did colour his views about playwrights. For a long while, I wanted to do Dennis Potter, very famous TV playwright. But Plumley said, "Oh, no, can't do him. He's nothing. He hasn't written a single play for the West End." And in fact, I actually went ahead on holidays. I mean, he came back to find he was doing Dennis Potter. There was certainly an atmosphere about the interview. I mean, it turned out to be a very good interview, because Dennis Potter has an awful lot to say for himself. So, you know, it was an interesting programme, but he still didn't think that Dennis Potter, and he hadn't made it.
By this stage, the early inhibitions about who qualified as a castaway had gone. Certainly, politicians were beginning to flock to the island in swarms. Edward Heath, James Callaghan and Mrs. Thatcher and almost everyone else went. Mrs. Thatcher taking with her, in the year before she was elected Prime Minister, A Guide to Survival.
I should turn to something practical. And I found a book. It's called The Survival Handbook. self-sufficiency for everyone. And it even tells you how to make a boat. It tells you how to weave. It tells you how to cook all sorts of things, about making long bows and arrows. Don't you think that would just be right?
Ah, it's a book that no castaway should be without.
So as it approached its 40th anniversary in 1982, the programme was an established fixture in the nation's life. It had changed its focus gradually and almost unnoticed because its style and its presentation had remained rigidly the same. On one occasion in 1964, there had been an absurd episode which seemed to ensure that forever the island and its accoutrements would be undisturbed. This is what happened. Pedants complained that if it was a tropical island, it couldn't have herring gulls from the northern hemisphere flying around. It was decreed that the seagulls of the signature tune, By a Sleepy Lagoon by Eric Coates, should go. And they did, to be replaced by sooty tern chicks and white-tailed tropical birds. And moreover, the tune itself appeared in a new form. It lasted only 8 months before the new birds were shooed away and the seagulls returned. But time was moving on relentlessly. Having been a programme where the music dominated, it was becoming more of an autobiographical excursion. And the programme was about to enter a turbulent period.
One of the BBC's most enduring broadcasters, Roy Plumley, has died at the age of 71. For generations of listeners, he'll always be associated with Desert Island...
It was May 1985, and now everything had to change. Indeed, there was an argument in the BBC about whether the programme should disappear with its creator. The managing director of BBC Network Radio, David Hatch, who was controller of Radio 4 at the time.
I came to the view that it should survive, really, for two reasons. One, it should be a sort of permanent memorial to Roy himself. And secondly, it is such a brilliant format, it would be silly to lose it. It was then who? And that then, of course, you get to the really thorny bit, because you then have to decide whether you're going to have someone who's like Roy or somebody who's going to be different from Roy. And, I mean, the history of people replacing distinguished broadcasting figures is not a good one. You know, if you follow Terry Wogan into the Radio 2 chair or you follow Sir Robin Day into Question Time, you know, you get into difficulties. So this was awkward. If you have someone who's similar, they get beaten up because they're not as good as the original. If it's different, they get beaten up because they're different. Anyway, I think it's now on the record that my initial call was to John Donne, who I regarded as similar. And John turned it down for hugely proper and professional reasons. His argument was, I do five interviews for Radio 2 each week, plus the rest of the programme. I haven't really enough time to research and do it to the standard that I would like. And that was a perfectly good, honest, what you'd expect from John. So I then took the second option, which is let's do different, and chose Michael, who of course then got all the flack that I've just talked about as being different.
The phase that followed was awkward for everybody involved. Roy Plumley had left a letter for his wife passing on the copyright of the programme which he believed he had, and she had her own ideas about a successor. The BBC's ideas were different. When David Hatch chose Michael Parkinson, who after all had become the star chat show host of the 70s on television, Mrs. Plumley made her unhappiness public.
I felt that Michael Parkinson, though he's admirable in his own broadcast, he was not the right choice for that, I felt sure, and I felt Roy would not be happy with that choice. And possibly I reacted rather strongly at that time because it was a very difficult time for me. And I possibly antagonised Michael Parkinson a bit, which I didn't intend to do. But I was annoyed at the way it was done, too.
And traditional stalwarts rallied round. Richard Ingrams.
The BBC made a great mistake in bringing on Parkinson, and I know the reason they did it, and perhaps why they also introduced Lawley, which is that they were both well-known personalities as a result of being on television. which is not the right qualification for being the presenter of a radio programme, in my view.
But the programme has continued to be a great success.
I agree. I agree it has. But I think there's another objection to both of them, actually, and that is that I think you have to have someone doing it who has some interest in or love for music. I never felt with either Parkinson or Lawley that they had any interest in or appreciation of the music that was being played.
But in 1985, at the moment of transition, Hatch wasn't going to change. Parkinson was the man.
No great broadcaster is the same as another great broadcaster. They want to wear their own shoes. And Michael wanted it to be his programme, and therefore it had to be a different programme. So he pulled it his way. And that, of course, upset a lot of the listeners who wanted it the same as ever, as they always do.
Parkinson began to present Desert Island Discs in January 1986.
It seemed to me that it was a bit soft. It was a bit predictable. You can't change the format. The format's perfect. It's that which has sustained it throughout the years. Not any one person. The format is perfect. And the only way you can change that is by changing the personality of the person running the programme. And that was me. And that's what I brought to it. I went for a different range of guests. I was accused by certain people, not too far from Rod Plumley, of having soccer players on my programme. Is there anything wrong in that? In fact, if you looked at the 80-odd guests that I had two soccer players on the programme. Actually, what the difference was, that was two more than Roy Plumley would have had. I mean, I don't think there was ever a recorded instance of a soccer player. So the range of people, I think, changed. The sweep of people changed.
Did you resent the criticism that there was, particularly from Diana Plumley, that you weren't the right person, that somehow this great sort of national institution had been invaded by a chat show host from television and this wasn't appropriate?
I did. I did object to it quite rightly because, I mean, the fact that I'm a chat show host ignores the fact that I've been a journalist all my working life. That made me particularly cross. I wasn't surprised by it. I was ready for it. I wasn't ready for the kind of willingness there was in the press to actually take everything that Mrs. Plumley said as being holy writ and to ignore in the main my defence. I mean, I thought that was a touch unfair. I also felt incredibly inhibited in that I felt I couldn't actually answer properly and as fully as I'd like to Mrs. Plumley, who, after all, I mean, she was a widow, she was grieving, I suppose, and it would have been unseemly and wrong to have done that. So I did feel, in a sense, limited in my response. The other thing, too, of course, that I was quite aware of, too, was that this feeling of invading, of this coarse-grained fellow invading this sort of rather sort of precious area, was actually something felt deeply by one or two people within the BBC. I mean, let's be fair here. My problem was not so much from what came outside from the BBC, but from what came within the BBC. And I was very aware that there were one or two people who actually disapproved of me for many reasons.
Do you think that one of the reasons for that disapproval, if indeed it was there in that way, was that you were trying to do the interviews in a different way, that you were deliberately trying to be perhaps more penetrating, less interested in whether they could build a treehouse, and more interested on whether they had been engaged in some kind of scandalous activity or whatever it happened to be?
I didn't actually change my style for the programme. What I've always thought about, the beauty of Desert Island Disc, is that it is the most wonderful vehicle for doing an interview. It is the most marvellous way of getting people who normally would not relax and talk to you to talk about themselves.
Because you both have to engage in the fantasy.
Exactly so. And also, too, because I always felt, too, there was something very revealing in the choice of music. Always. And there was always one record, I felt, which was the question I dared ask, this is an affair. It was always lurking there, I thought. There's always one. And I think that all you had to do, you didn't have to be an aggressive interviewer or a particularly brilliant interviewer, given that that was the case. You just had to sit there, keep a straight face and ask the ordinary questions, which is why one was really sort of, not cross, but I didn't quite understand how all of a sudden Parkinson, who'd been accused hitherto of being too soft in it as an interviewer, was now becoming Jack the Ripper. I mean, I couldn't quite work that one out.
When you left after a couple of years, you were quoted widely as saying it was a silly little programme, and you were, of course, accused of knocking a sort of great institution, and it was all sour grapes and all the rest of it. Do you regret saying silly little programme?
I meant silly little programme. I meant silly in the whimsical sense. I meant silly in the flippant sense. I think it is that. It's a parlour game. That's all it is. I mean, let's be frank about it. Not to say that within, as we've talked about, that within it you can't actually establish a wonderful relationship between interviewer and interviewee and the audience. It's a wonderful device of getting a good interview. It is still, if you strip it down, a silly little game.
Did you enjoy it?
I loved it. I loved every minute of it. It was wonderful. I wouldn't have missed it for anything, Mrs. Plumley or not.
Well, he may have loved it, but 2 years seemed enough. There was another change, and Sue Lawley arrived.
I was very surprised when I was asked to become the host, as it were, the custodian of Radio 4's infamous desert island. I wasn't sure I was up to it, to be honest. I think I didn't feel old enough, strangely. One feels that one ought to be really very grey. I am a bit grey, but I felt I ought to be greyer. I was desperately excited by it. I knew I wanted to do it, and I knew, as one often knows on these occasions, I knew what I was going to say before I decided what to say. But I was, I suppose, more than anything else, deeply flattered. Because it's a very special programme. It's enormously important, not just to the BBC, but as I know from the letters we received, to thousands of people across the land, millions, dare I say. And I think, therefore, one felt, as I say, very flattered, and one felt that one was being asked to do something that was really, in broadcasting terms, quite important.
One of the things she did first was to try to re-emphasise the atmosphere of the island, which had seemed to bore Parkinson. And she got her internal row over early, getting the programme moved from the Radio 3 music department to a Radio 4 department, and she settled in. The style is different, as Parkinson's was. The skill is in changing the way the programme is done without appearing to change it. Sue Lawley, having plied her interviewer's trade in the 70s and 80s, is clearly going to ask more penetrating questions than Plumley would have thought proper. But does she accede to requests that certain matters should be avoided?
Usually when people ask, one does accede. That is to say, they're usually very intensely personal ones, the breakdown of a marriage, or indeed it might have been the loss of a child or something, which is not necessarily in the public domain, not relevant. There's only been one occasion on which there's been a problem on this, because, as I've said before, I don't think that Enoch Powell or Arthur Scargill would ask very public moments in their lives to be ignored. My one downfall on this was Ken Dodd, who I believed entirely was willing to talk about his legal problems with the Inland Revenue. I think it's an important part of his life. It's something that's very much in the public domain, and we've all read about, but obviously wanted to ask again his personal experience of it all. I think it would have been very interesting, and I believe that's what he was going to do. When we eventually arrived sitting across the table from each other, I asked the question and he refused to answer. And he said that he believed a deal had been done whereby he didn't have to talk about this. I have to say no such deal was done. And had he asked, then we would not have gone ahead with that booking.
And did you patch that one up?
Yes, but poorly.
The style changes with the times, but the essence is the same. People talk about personal things, and on a good day they reveal more than perhaps they intended. But they don't mind, because the setting is benign. Some say no, but they're certainly fewer in number than the people who can't wait to say yes. Here is the dilemma that's faced the programme for 50 years. Is it something that should be regarded as conferring some kind of status, or should it try from time to time to surprise, perhaps even to shock, by daring? At first glance, the two roles seem incompatible. You start with the obvious fact that it's become a mark of distinction to be asked to appear. David Hatch.
I think people regard it as the unofficial honours list, really. It doesn't matter wherever I go, whoever I meet. Somehow the conversation comes round to this if they are distinguished in any kind of way. And they sort of imply that they've chosen their list. And sort of vaguely hinting that they would quite like the invitation to tell the nation about it.
But if that's true, how do we explain Diana Moseley? This is one of the great broadcasting episodes of recent years, still argued about inside the BBC as well as by listeners. Diana Moseley, widow of Sir Oswald the Blackshirt, friend and admirer of Hitler, was a castaway in 1989. But many people thought that Desert Island Discs was no place for her. Sue Lawley has no doubts.
I was happy that Diana Moseley was invited onto the programme. I think that she was an entirely justifiable invitation. And indeed, BBC willing, I would invite her again tomorrow if she hadn't already done it. I think that she is a fascinating woman in her own right. She's one of the Mitford sisters. Fascinating family, goes without saying. She had also lived in Paris and socialised with the abdicated king, Edward and Mrs. Simpson, knew them well, had light to throw on them, but also, of course, had met, socialised, had long conversations with, enjoyed the company of Adolf Hitler. How fascinating. She is part of our history. I think that as long as she was properly, which I hope she was, tested on her husband's anti-Semitic beliefs. We believe them to be anti-Semitic. She, of course, defended them. But as long as she was properly tested on that, then she was entirely valid. I have no regrets about that programme.
Do you think there is anyone whom you would find it, I don't mean necessarily a name, but is there a boundary beyond which you'd find it difficult to go? Will there be people,
yes,
who are beyond the pale?
To an extent, to a very large extent, Desert Island Discs is a celebration of a person. So, yes, I give you that. But we broadcast 42 interviews a year. I think if they were all entirely, without exception, celebrations, we would become very slightly bland. But is there a line beyond which one wouldn't go? Yes, of course there is, and I think we all know, I think everyone knows where that line is.
I don't think it's about approval. I think it's about public recognition that people are public figures in some kind of way or other. And that they have interesting things to say and have made a contribution to public life.
So Diana Mosley appeared, but did it destroy the myth of the programme? The truth is probably that Desert Island Discs can accommodate characters who raise these passions, containing them. No doubt there are limits, but who can say that we've reached them yet? As it reaches 50, this is a mature programme, and it can cope with the storms. It does it by being embedded in our lives, for two reasons, I think. Firstly, because nearly everybody in every corner of public life has either been a castaway or will be. And secondly, there's hardly one of us who hasn't wondered for an enjoyable moment what our discs would be and how we'd choose our luxury. Within a few years of its invention, the programme already had that grip. Lord Donoghue told a marvellous story about Herbert Morrison.
I once wrote a book, a biography, of a British Foreign Secretary who used to be Deputy Prime Minister called Herbert Morrison, Mr. London Rang. And when I was writing the biography with a friend, we discovered that Herbert Morrison, although he had achieved everything, felt a failure because he'd never been invited onto Desert Island Discs, and indeed in his wallet he carried a scruffy old piece of paper on which he'd written down the 8 titles, and so he'd got it ready just in case he was invited at the last moment.
And how many of us have done that? That's a touching illustration of the fantasy at work. In the end, it hardly matters what storms swirl around the programme about presenters or about guests. Everyone is levelled by it. No one can take a friend or a dog as a luxury or a two-way radio to the island, and every choice you make is going to be listened to for what it says secretly about you, as well as what you intend it to say. And of course, the music will pool all sorts of characters together. How interesting it was that the most controversial castaway of recent times, Diana Mosley, should choose among her records the one that in all the 50 years has been the most popular choice. Beethoven's 9th Symphony. No doubt it means different things to us all, and it should. The fantasy isn't collective, it's individual. We all know the island privately in our minds. It remains, as it was always meant to be, a solitary place.